This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, June 22, 2010. In Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young. Coming up on today's newscast, Congress continues to wrangle over a financial reform bill. We'll examine the implications of the first Supreme Court ruling on a genetically modified food crop, and the U.S. Social Forum opens in Detroit.
If poverty is going to be abolished, if it's going to happen, it's going to need the energy and the commitment of everybody in this room and beyond.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. According to a congressional report released late Monday, the United States is paying millions of dollars for bribes and security to warlords in Afghanistan. In return, they provide protection for local trucks delivering supplies to U.S. bases. The agreement between the U.S. and contractors operating in Afghanistan states that the contractor is responsible for all security, not the U.S. government. Evidence included in the report proves that U.S. officials were aware of the situation and took no action. Further, the report, called Warlord Incorporated, says that much of the so-called security is actually gained through protection money paid by contractors to insurgents. The insurgents include the Quetta-Shura, led by former leaders of the Afghan Taliban, one of the very enemies U.S. forces seek to rout. U.S. Representative John Tierney, who ordered the review in response to an article in The Nation magazine, says the findings range from sobering to shocking. He calls for the Department of Defense to take responsibility for all security and for the U.S. government to take a hard look at how U.S. NATO contracts actually fuel corruption in Afghanistan. In Pakistan today, the Taliban issued a chilling warning to anyone transporting NATO supplies into Afghanistan. Nathan Moore reads for our correspondent in the tribal areas, Gabe Matthews.
Taliban militants distributed pamphlets today that read, quote, "All those who carry NATO supplies must be killed." They also threatened to, quote, "target family members of all those who guard or carry NATO supplies to Afghanistan," adding that this would be the very last warning from our side to all people. The pamphlet is signed with the Taliban stamp and undersigned by Hakim Ullah Massoud, who was reportedly killed in a U.S. drone some months back, but his body was never found. All convoys of supplies to Afghanistan from Pakistan have been at a standstill since yesterday. 33-year-old Saeed Shah is a truck driver who has transported NATO supplies for the last 2 years.
I am a poor man and carry NATO supplies to support my family, but now I can't take the risk. It was very good for me to carry NATO supplies because I could stay home at night, but now I will only travel within Pakistan.
I'm Nathan Moore, reading for Gabe Matthews in the tribal areas of Pakistan.
The highest-ranking U.S. military official in Afghanistan, General Stanley McChrystal, spent his day on the phone today apologizing to various high-level government officials over tactless and critical remarks he and his staff made in an interview with Rolling Stone. McChrystal has been summarily summoned to the Oval Office, where he will meet with President Obama and Pentagon officials tomorrow. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said today that Obama has not yet spoken to McChrystal.
Without a doubt, General McChrystal, as Secretary Gates has said, has made an enormous mistake. A mistake that he'll get a chance to talk about and answer to tomorrow to both officials in the Pentagon and to the Commander-in-Chief.
Does the President still have confidence that General McChrystal can run this war?
We should wait and see what the outcome of that meeting is.
Gibbs deftly avoided all questions regarding McChrystal's job security, saying all options are on the table. But one person has already been fired, Duncan Boothby, the general's aide who booked the interview with Rolling Stone. A shutdown continues in Kashmir today, where locals are under total curfew after broad protests in recent days over the deaths of two young men in separate incidents involving the police. Shahnawaz Khan reports from Srinagar.
Last week, Kashmiris protested the death of a teenager, Tufail Muttu, at the hands of police. This week, the story repeats. Paramilitary troopers fatally beat a young Kashmiri man, Rafiq Ahmed Bangru, last week while they chased youth protesting Tufail's death by a tear gas shell. Bangaru spent nearly a week in the hospital. He was declared dead on Saturday. His funeral procession saw more clashes of residents with police and paramilitary. Police fired upon the procession, killing another youth, Jawed Malla, and injuring few others. Malla's death triggered even more clashes in the city. Separatists called for a shutdown on Monday and Tuesday, and authorities responded with a strict undeclared curfew in the old city, requiring everyone to stay indoors at all times. Newspaper reports say police have arrested more than 100 teenagers in the last week on charges of stone pelting. Shahnawaz Khan, FSRN, Srinagar.
A federal judge in New Orleans overturned a moratorium on new deepwater drilling today. Judge Martin Feldman wrote that the six-month ban on new permits seems to assume that the disaster at one rig implies that all such rigs pose a similar threat. The decision was sought by businesses that provide transport to and from the offshore platforms. Voters in Fremont, Nebraska, approved a referendum yesterday that makes it illegal for undocumented workers to rent a home or hold most jobs within city limits. Those limits do not, however, include two major nearby meatpacking houses. They'll still be able to hire undocumented workers, as will local residents who need help around the house. The ACLU has already announced it will challenge the law. Voters in four states are heading to the polls today. In North Carolina, Progressive Secretary of State Democrat Elaine Marshall faces off with former state senator and Iraq vet Cal Cunningham. The winner will run for U.S. Senate in the fall. In South Carolina, runoffs include Republicans Nikki Haley and Gresham Barrett, who are battling for the ballot in the governor's race. And Republican voters in two congressional districts must choose their candidate as well. In one of those, African-American Tim Brown challenges Paul Thurmond, son of the late Senator Strom Thurmond. And in Utah, Tea Partier Mike Lee challenges a businessman, Tim Bridgewater. Finally, in Mississippi, the Republican candidate for a seat in the U.S. House will be chosen as well. For FSRN from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Shannon Young in for Dorian Marina. The relief effort in Haiti is losing steam, according to a Senate report released Tuesday. An estimated 1.5 million people remain homeless after the January earthquake, with hundreds of thousands living in tent cities without basic sanitation and nutrition. There's blame to go around, but part of the problem is that billions of dollars pledged for reconstruction have not been delivered. Tanya Snyder reports.
5 months after the quake that killed more than 230,000 people, Haiti is still suffering the consequences.
The food, the water, the security aren't reaching the average people.
Joya Jefferson Nouri of TransAfrica Forum says big organizations like the Red Cross have failed to get aid where it's needed.
Corporate NGOs, governments, etc. moved into Haiti and took over. At what point did anybody, including the United States, pause and ask the Haitian government, how best should we move here, and how best do we assist you?
The Senate's 8-page report, released Tuesday, is based on interviews with government officials, NGOs, and Haitian residents, as well as on-site visits to camps, hospitals, and schools. It acknowledges that Haitian civil society has been left out of the rebuilding process, but it throws much of the blame back on the Haitian government. Senator Richard Lugar, the top Republican on the Foreign Relations Committee, puts the responsibility for the slow recovery on the Haitian government.
I think we can be encouraging, but those who have responsibility will have to finally fashion the solutions.
The Haitian government itself was left in ruins by the earthquake, perhaps best illustrated by the literal collapse of the presidential palace, which has yet to be rebuilt. But the report says the Haitian government has not done an effective job of communicating to Haitians that it is in charge and ready to lead the rebuilding effort. Haiti's legislative branch is also in shambles. Parliamentary elections scheduled for last February were canceled after the earthquake, meaning members' terms expired and no one came in to replace them. President René Préval's term ends next February, making it that much more important that elections go forward this November. U.S. lawmakers did share some of the blame for the slow pace of reconstruction. Senator Lugar acknowledged that much of the U.S. aid money hasn't yet arrived.
Well, obviously, it should have been delivered some time ago.
Congress has stalled on a bill that includes $2.8 billion in reconstruction aid for Haiti. Of almost $10 billion pledged to Haiti by wealthy countries and individuals at a donors' conference in March, only Brazil has sent its contribution, totaling $55 million. Timmy Gerson, Advocacy Director for American Jewish World Service, says it's not just about getting the money to Haiti. It has to be distributed right.
It's incredibly focused in Port-au-Prince, and it's not getting outside of Port-au-Prince. The problem is that you had a mass outflux from Port-au-Prince after the immediate crisis of folks into rural areas or other cities. And now you're having a reverse migration of everyone coming back, and the reason is because there's not near enough aid and reconstruction and projects to figure out ways to keep those people there and to let them earn livelihoods.
Gerson also says international donors need to do a better job at hiring Haitians to do the reconstruction work instead of just bringing in their own employees.
The biggest need that Haitians have identified right now, interestingly, if you ask their number one issue, they don't say shelter, they don't say water, they say jobs. There's clearly a ton of work to be done there, and clearly Haitians should be the one doing it.
Before the earthquake, Haiti was already the poorest country in the hemisphere. The long-term reconstruction aid promised, and then delayed by countries around the world, was supposed to rebuild a new Haiti with more opportunities for the people. Joy Jefferson-Nori of TransAfrica Forum says many Haitians spent their entire day's wages just paying for transportation back and forth to work every day, with nothing left over to feed their families.
We could slowly and surely affirm a sweatshop economy for Haiti. That's not progress.
Last week, former President Bill Clinton inaugurated the Interim Haiti Reconstruction Commission, overseeing Haiti's recovery. The Senate's report calls the commission the best near-term prospect for driving rebuilding. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
The Obama administration today outlined its strategic plan for ending homelessness. The roadmap unveiled by the Interagency Council on Homelessness aims to end veteran and chronic homelessness by 2015 and that of youth, families, and children by 2020. Secretary of Veterans Affairs Eric Shinseki says that while the numbers of homeless veterans have decreased by 88,000 over the past 6 years, those who remain homeless are the most difficult to serve.
And so as the numbers go down, the climb becomes steeper. To meet that challenge, we are expanding existing programs and developing new initiatives. This year, we are investing $500 million in programs designed specifically for homeless veterans. And the budget request before Congress right now would increase this amount to $799 million in 2011.
This strategy combines efforts of all three levels of government, public service providers, and the private sector, with affordable housing and employment opportunities considered key elements. HUD Secretary Sean Donovan calls the plan, quote, the most far-reaching and ambitious plan to end homelessness in our history. Advocacy groups welcome the strategies to eliminate homelessness, but some, including the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty, point out that the plan fails to detail how the administration will fund the initiatives. The organization also wanted language in the strategic plan to define housing as a human right. The House and Senate continued to iron out the difference in legislation to reform the financial industry. The lawmakers successfully kept in a measure that exempts auto dealers from oversight by a new regulatory body. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
A select group of House and Senate lawmakers have begun the second week of negotiations to iron out the differences between the versions of the financial reform bill. At the heart of this week's discussion is the Consumer Federal Protection Bureau, the new agency to protect consumers from abusive lending practices by credit card companies, mortgage lenders, and others. Edmir Zwinski, consumer advocate at the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, says the protection for consumers in the bill is strong. It's now up to lawmakers to resist lobbyist pressure to weaken it.
We want to make sure that there are steps forward at the end of this week and no steps backwards, and then that we leave room for more steps forward in the future.
Numerous efforts by Republicans to limit the Consumer Protection Agency's scope failed. During the conference committee, Republican Michael Garrett of North Carolina bluntly expressed his feelings.
The chairman is often wont to say that anytime we offer an amendment that that our side of the aisle just doesn't like the agency, and that for that reason we're going to do anything we can to rein it in. And that is absolutely true. We do not like the agency, and yes, we would like to rein it in.
While attempts to weaken the Consumer Bureau were rejected, attempts to strengthen it failed as well. One of the things the House and the Senate must reach agreement on is an issue with auto dealers. In the House bill, auto dealers who give loans to customers are excluded from regulatory oversight under the Consumer Protection Bureau. In the Senate version of the bill, the auto dealers are subject to oversight. To bridge that gap, Representative Luis Gutierrez offered a compromise proposal. It would require the Consumer Protection Agency to step in against auto dealers if necessary.
The political reality is that those of us who have fought against an auto dealer carve-out can't prevail. I submit to you that my amendment offers a more reasonable alternative that makes more sense in terms of consumer protections while giving special consideration for auto dealers, something in line with the political reality I'm facing here.
That compromise was rejected. But the issue is not dead. Another compromise offer will likely be offered as early as Tuesday, and auto dealers will continue their aggressive lobbying campaign against it. Also to be debated this week is how to deal with the shadow banking system, also known as derivatives. The Volcker Rule could also be debated. It would prohibit banks from the risky behavior of using the bank's money to invest in hedge funds or proprietary trading for the bank's own profit. Democrats hope to finish the bill by the end of the week to send it to the president's desk before July 4th. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The U.S. Supreme Court ruled on a case yesterday involving biotech seed giant Monsanto. The company challenged a court order preventing the commercialization of its patented Roundup Ready variety of genetically modified alfalfa. The U.S. Department of Agriculture approved the crop in 2006 using a controversial deregulation method. The Center for Food Safety responded on behalf of a coalition of organic and conventional farmers, arguing that the USDA's approval violated federal environmental laws. A district court agreed and ordered the USDA to comply with federal law prior to approving the new crop for commercialization. The court also placed an injunction on planting in the interim, but the Supreme Court overturned the injunction on Monday. Joining me to talk about the case is George Kimbrell, senior staff attorney at the Center for Food Safety and lead counsel on the case. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me.
The ruling has been widely described as a victory for Monsanto. Do you agree?
No. I think the mainstream media, for the most part, missed the boat, unfortunately, although we've done our best to try to get the word out to the contrary. You know, it's a complicated legal procedural context. First of all, I should say that the fact that the Department of Agriculture violated U.S. environmental laws in initially approving Roundup Ready alfalfa was not appealed, and it wasn't an issue in front of the Supreme Court. It's undisputed that they did, and in fact, they've been working since 2007 to remedy, if possible, that failing. The issue in front of the Supreme Court was a fairly narrow one, which was the type and the process legally in which the district court had put in place the relief that he granted to us for the statutory violation, the breaking of the law by the Department of Agriculture. And the Supreme Court essentially yesterday ruled that the district court erred in part by granting us two forms of relief when one would do. Essentially, the district court stopped the planting using a belt and suspenders method. It used both an injunction and what's called a vacatur or a vacator. That is, it set aside the agency's decision that reverted Roundup Ready alfalfa back to its pre-commercialization status as a regulated article. As a regulated article, it can't be sold commercially. It can only be grown for experimental purposes. Yesterday, the Supreme Court removed the suspenders and left the belt on our remedy. It removed the suspenders in part because it said we already had the belt, that is, we already had the remedy that we needed, and the other part was superfluous. But the bottom line for farmers and for the environment and for consumers is, as of today, in light of the Supreme Court's ruling, unlike what Monsanto is claiming, no one can plant Roundup Ready alfalfa or sell it. It's still illegal until and unless the Department of Agriculture complies with U.S. environmental laws and takes further action, at which time we and the public at large will have the opportunity to challenge that decision should we see fit in the court of law. So the ban, quote-unquote, was not lifted on Roundup Ready alfalfa yesterday. No one today can plant Roundup Ready alfalfa that couldn't plant it yesterday or the day before.
But part of this challenge was about how USDA had skirted the National Environmental Policy Act by deregulating GM alfalfa. Does the USDA still have the possibility to deregulate?
Yes, they're looking right now. The Obama administration's Department of Agriculture has a decision in front of it, whether or not they want to, or they decide to, rather, to deregulate, or as you said, deregulate, or, you know, that means commercialize Roundup Ready alfalfa again. It'll be a new decision based on new environmental compliance documents under both the National Environmental Policy Act, as you mentioned, as well as the Endangered Species Act and the Plant Protection Act and other statutes. Other sister agencies like EPA, the Fish and Wildlife Service, will also be weighing in on that decision. The previous administration had a draft of what they were thinking that came out late last year. That draft received over 200,000 public comments. The public comment period closed on it in March of 2010. 200,000 public comments opposed to deregulating it again, I should be clear. That is a massive outpouring of public participation demanding that Roundup Ready alfalfa not be commercialized from farmers and the public. In the history of administrative procedure, there have probably been a handful of public notice and comment periods that have received more than 200,000 comments, and never before has there been that many filed with regards to a biotech crop issue. I can tell you that.
Since the Supreme Court did not rule on the controversy over the application of federal environmental law and the deregulation door is still open, would you, as lead counsel in this case, be prepared to challenge deregulation were it to occur?
I can't comment on any future litigation by the Center for Food Safety, or certainly, you know, not similarly from other groups that work on these issues. I can just say, you know, we filed comments on the draft EIS. I know that there were a lot of other comments filed on it as well. And, you know, we're cautiously optimistic and that the Obama administration and the Department of Agriculture is going to be looking at this decision with fresh eyes and make an independent decision, one that complies with U.S. environmental laws. But if they don't, then we will look at the potential for litigation.
George Kimbrell is the senior staff attorney at the Center for Food Safety. Thank you for coming on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Thousands marched through the streets of Detroit today to kick off the second ever U.S. Social Forum. The forum is bringing together activists from all over the country for 5 days to brainstorm about how to create a more just society in the U.S. and around the world. FSRN's Andrew Stelzer is at the forum and brings us this report about what's happening this week and how out-of-town activists are hoping to strengthen some local campaigns.
Even before the official opening of the Social Forum Tuesday afternoon, Cobo Hall in downtown Detroit was swarming with activists. Many were in workshops focused on the city of Detroit, a city with high unemployment, foreclosures, and poverty. Minneapolis resident Rose Brewer is a member of the Social Forum's organizing committee.
It goes to the heart, to the very heart of what the Social Forum is about. People are suffering. People know that we need another system if poverty is going to be abolished. And if it's going to happen, it's going to need the energy and the commitment of everybody in this room and beyond.
More than 12,000 people are registered for the United States version of the World Social Forum. The next 5 days will feature workshops and plenary sessions on just about anything related to social justice. Wednesday will focus on movement building in Detroit and throughout the U.S. Thursday will shift to linking domestic and global issues. And Friday's theme is alternatives and solutions for transforming society. Many here say that transformation is already taking place. At the site of Detroit's famed Heidelberg Public Art Installation, several dozen people gathered around the half-buried frame of a Hummer, now covered with dirt and blossoming plants. The mock funeral, organized by Code Pink, is to commemorate the last Hummer going off the GM assembly line in May. Code Pink's Medea Benjamin says her group's 10-year campaign against the Hummer was one of many around the country that raised awareness about the wastefulness and environmental destruction caused by the gas-guzzling vehicle.
In a sense, I think there is a real transformation of the kind of cool that one once had driving in a Hummer to the kind of cachet that one has now when you ride in a hybrid, if you have a smart car.
There are four coordinated mass actions taking place throughout the week, identified by Detroiters as local campaigns which could use the leverage provided by thousands of allies from around the country. There will be an action protesting power shutoffs by DTE Energy, which activists say led to a number of deaths last winter. The Restaurant Opportunity Center will be leading a protest against Dearborn restaurant Andiamo's, which workers say owes employees tens of thousands of dollars in back pay. There will be an action against Chase Bank protesting foreclosures throughout the city of Detroit. And the final day of the forum will feature a march to the world's largest trash incinerator, which has caused health problems for many nearby African-American residents. Activists want the city of Detroit to end the contract with the incinerator's operator. Adele Nieves is the National Communications Coordinator for the Social Forum. She says that for two of those campaigns in particular, a massive protest this week could be a breaking point in the long-running campaigns.
Andiamo's hasn't spoken with the workers the whole year, but they've been protesting for the whole year in front of Andiamo's, and with this big action, I think they're coming to the point of, okay, we're ready to sit down. And having this come out of the U.S. Social Forum is just, it pushes it even further, and we're so grateful for people coming together to do that. Second is the incinerator. Since that contract is up, this is really the time for us to push to not have these massive asthma rates and have the government take a stand for the community.
Other gatherings took place in the days leading up to the U.S. Social Forum. Hundreds participated in the Allied Media Conference for independent media makers. The Progressive Communicators Network had a training on framing and messaging. And the first ever Jewish anti-Zionist conference brought together about 200 anti-Zionist Jews.
Anytime anyone says anything about Palestine, you get called a self-hating Jew, you get called a traitor, all these things.
Greg Hamm is a national organizer with the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network.
The reason we're here in Detroit is because the U.S. Social Forum is coming up. And, you know, this isn't one issue. We're connected to, like I said, the anti-war movement. I mean, like, how does feminism relate to this? How does, you know, land rights relate to this? So we want to be in all those discussions, and we also just, we want to be building a broader left.
The motto of the forum is another world is possible, another U.S. is necessary, another Detroit is happening. In the chronically neglected city of Detroit, organizers and activists hope that this week can be a dissection of what's gone wrong and help steer our entire society towards a more sustainable and just future. Andrew Stelzer, FSRN, Detroit.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Washington, D.C. editor was Leanne Caldwell. Today's technical production team at KPFAM Berkeley includes Scott Pham and Antonio Ortiz. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young.